Today is July 22nd, 2020. My name is Noah Schoen, and I'm an interviewer on the OHSS Education Narratives Project. I am here in Boston, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, interviewing Maya Reed, who is in Hudson, New York. And just to start, Maya, could you tell me a little bit about where you come from?
I was born in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and when I was two, my parents and I moved to the state of New York because my dad got a job as head librarian at the New York Botanical Garden. So I've lived my whole life in New York State, but I consider myself a Michiganian. So that's in part because my great-grandparents continue to live in Michigan, and we would go up every summer, and so I actually consider that place in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan is actually my home, and I think it's very much based on having known my great-grandmother until I was 18, so that's very much my ancestral base. But I live in New York, and I live in the Hudson Valley, and the Hudson Valley has always been a very important part of my life. Access to the river, I've only lived away from the river maybe once in my adult life and childhood. So I always sort of stay close to the Hudson. There's sort of a power and magic to it that is important to me. And let's see, and you know, I grew up in the suburbs of New York City so that my dad and then my mom could both commute to work at the Botanical Garden. And that was, we went to work with them a lot. So I felt very aware of the city. I felt like I had a strong and personal connection to that metropolis. But then because we lived in the suburbs and we're very close to lots of state and county parks, I felt very connected also to sort of, not quite wilderness, but forested woodlands and nature. So I felt like I lived between those two worlds, never truly felt at home in the suburbs as a child. And as an adult and a parent, when it came time to find a place to live and we had chosen to stay in that area, we discovered this small community, a small Hudson River city called Peekskill that my husband and I had lived on either side of our whole childhood. And it was where we could find affordable apartment as young parents. And in choosing that apartment, we discovered kind of the amazing little culture of small Hudson River cities that were a nice cross between a small town, because they were the right size and there were all these different neighborhoods, and also like a city. There was the incredible diversity that a place like New York City offered, but in a very sort of manageable size and a size where you could actually know people who lived in all of these different neighborhoods and that you were neighbors with or your children went to school with. And so they became kind of the perfect place for me to live and raise a family. And so I've not departed from that. As that place got more expensive and busier because of people from the city moving up and things like that, I found myself moving further north up the river, and I found the city of Hudson, which 19 years ago was a slower pace, very much alive because it's a county seat. And so there was sort of the everyday business of everyday people here, which is very important to me. And it was a place I could afford to live and have a studio to do my art and raise my family. Yeah, and so I just have always felt very at home in these small Hudson River cities. I also feel like it's a place that you can be involved if you choose. And I feel that there is a part of me that likes to sort of hermit away and be quiet, but there's also very much a part of me that needs and wants to connect not only to people and community, but also to impacting directions and changes that can happen to make a better community for all. And so Hudson keeps offering us these opportunities, both in good ways and bad ways. So that's where I come from.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about your relationship with your great-grandmother. Sounds like that was significant for you.
Hugely significant. I feel that she's sort of my guide. She's been my guide through childhood and continues to be as the adult that I am and sort of as the single woman that I am. And the story that always resonated with me, even though I knew her, but the story that my mother shared with me when I was pretty young was my great-grandmother lived on a flax farm somewhere in a rural part of Finland. And her brother had immigrated to this country. And she was at home with her younger brother and sisters. And I guess the farmer down the road had become a widower. And my great-grandmother's father basically made an agreement with this farmer that she was gonna like head over and kind of take care of him. And she was like, there is no way I'm doing that. I'm out of here. I'm gonna go join my brother in America. And he said, well, you'll have to get yourself to the train station. And so as probably a 18-year-old woman in the 1800s, she packed her suitcase and started walking down the road to wherever the train station was. And then not long after that, her father pulled up in the wagon and took her to the train station. And she headed off and landed in this country through Boston and ended up in Detroit and became sort of a housekeeper to a family that was well off. I don't know if she did any childcare, but I think she did cooking and housekeeping and met my great-grandfather. But she's, to me, that ability as a young woman, and especially at the time, but as a young woman to say, that's not my idea of my future. And to be able to say to very strong parental units, it doesn't match your plan, but I know what I need to do and to have the courage to do that. And I feel like that's what I've done sort of in a very quiet but a determined way my whole life. If somebody said no to me, I'm like, okay, I'm going to back down, but I'm still going to find a way to do what I'm going to do, you know. And she sewed the mittens and socks for all of the children in the family from the time she was 7. And growing up, every year, my brother and I would get a pair of hand-knit mittens from her. And she knit the tightest mittens that they were like waterproof, even though they were knitted. And they were beautiful. And I now have like a suitcase full of those mittens that someday I'll finish it, but I decided to like sew them together to make like a wool quilt. And then she started. And when I was 16, I just remember she didn't speak very good English, but she'd come out to the cabin and I remember one year I was like, I want you to teach me how to knit mittens. And we just sat together out in the sun in folding chairs, and she showed me how to knit mittens. And I don't knit mittens, but every now and then I have something that I would call a craving, an intense craving around making mittens. And so I'll maybe make one and then be like, okay, the craving's gone. But it's still like this watching her hands move. I loved her hands. I loved watching her hands paring potatoes and Yeah, she was quiet and she was beautiful. And I also felt like she always, and she, there was like a grace to her. Like, you know, she was always strong, but gentle. And I feel like those are things that, like, I really want to think that I can be myself, is have a strength, but gentleness, a welcomingness, but also just like get the business done. We eventually inherited her guest book, and everybody who signed the guest book was like, it was, Maria was so welcoming, and she makes the best coffee. And I dropped in and she just set coffee on the table for us. And again, you know, I just sort of feel like those are just such important qualities to have with family and friends and with people that you're just meeting, just sort of being able to open yourself into making people feel cared for and safe and welcome. And so, yeah, that's my great grandmother. Yeah. So, and I have a lot of, I inherited also, like, as after she passed and the house was being closed up, I got to be there and I was like, I have her aprons and I have some pans. And so I feel like the kitchen is a very important part of me. It's like therapeutic as well as a way to share, like, why cook if you can't share it? So I also feel very connected to her when I pull out the orange enameled pan to make the lasagna and I'm like, oh, it's Mayu's pan, and I put on an apron. And it's not to be like her, it's just I have these things and they're useful, and her hands touch them and now my hands touch them. And it's just a sort of way of, it's almost like passing a baton, you know, it like keeps the story going. It keeps the race, the race that we're in as human beings, that we have like a beginning and an end, but you can pass that on. And I try not to be nostalgic about it. I just sort of feel like, well, if that pan disappeared, I'd be sad, but it's here and it has meaning. And it has meaning to me. It doesn't have to have meaning to my children. You know, they might want to get rid of that pan when I'm gone, you know. But for me in my life, it's that token that helps me feel anchored in this world.
So we just took a short sound logistics break. And it's beautiful to hear these stories about your grandmother, Maya. Thank you for sharing them. One thing that I'm wondering about is what school was like for you growing up?
So that is a question that I have contemplated kind of, I feel again, like my whole life since first grade. So school was basically horrible beginning in first grade. I had, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, in the moment it was horrible and it kind of created a relationship to school that stayed with me through my whole life. And luckily there were a few exceptions because I had a handful of just extraordinary teachers. And then, of course, as you grow older and you reflect on and try to understand, well, why was it so bad? Or maybe why are some of the things that you still consider challenges and obstacles in your daily life? Like, where did those begin? Where were those beginning places? And again, like, I think a lot of things started in first grade with a teacher who was very new. I think that was like her first year of teaching when I got her. I had kindergarten. Kindergarten was great. Loved kindergarten. Just loved it as a place. Loved the feeling the teacher created. Like, she was an older woman and she just, there was just, it was like this safe nest. I don't really remember any of my classmates or interactions with them, but I just remember being able to move through that space and do what I needed to do and not be have anything imposed upon me, which to me, as I, as an educator now, I realize like that quality that that teacher had to be able to sort of move us from activity to activity, but I didn't feel like I was being pushed and managed and manipulated. And then first grade came along and I had this teacher who basically there were multiple times where I was like publicly humiliated in my class. And it just sort of, and I think it was because she was not seasoned. She was also incredibly like beautiful. She was young and she, for the time she was very stylish. So she sort of had teased, you know, that long hair, but that was like slightly teased to give it volume. And she just wore great clothes and she had a maxi coat, which was like, oh my God. And I just remember really wanting to connect with her and to be seen by her. And just, I remember feeling like I was always trying to like, oh, can I cut out the, you know, candy canes and help you do the bulletin board in the hallway? Because you always ask kids in class to help you. I want to be one of those kids. And just always trying to find her favor, but never attaining it. And in fact, being sort of humiliated by her many times. And so through that, I realized like the sort of the importance of a teacher, you know, it's like to sort of how your students feel not only in time, but how they move forward into like their next year and their next classroom and their next educational experience. So, you know, I disengaged from school very, very early. And so I think I spent a lot of my school time kind of just being there, but tuning it out because it wasn't a pleasant place to be. I remember kind of just being average, skating through. And then really looking for ways to get out early. So I actually was a Rotary exchange student my last year of high school because I found out my junior year that you could like go live abroad for a year. and I'm like, that's my way out. That like gets me out of this school. It also puts me out on a bit of an adventure. And I was definitely ready to not be living in suburbs anymore. I was definitely interested in not being in school anymore. And so, yeah, I just, that was my experience in school. So I really looked to my teachers who were the exceptions as, again, sort of modeling, like I really think about like how they did things. What made it like a different classroom and learning experience from like all of the other classes, you know, and what were they doing that was so different or that shifted sort of what that experience of learning was. Yeah. And so I feel like right now, I feel like that I can't be the only one who has had that experience. And I know school works well for some kids. There's like that percentage that they can just sort of start and that they're fine in that. But there are so many students on either side of that line that get lost. And that can happen so early. And like how as educators can we take that responsibility on, not because we have to, but because if there's a way to connect with each student as that individual, like that's gonna enrich our lives too. Like, so, and it did help me find, right now I'm an early educator, so I'm working with infants and children up till they head on to preschool usually, so 3 or 4 years old. And I've been doing a lot of professional development on my own as I find I get stuck as an educator and feel like I could be doing things better. I'm searching out like what philosophies and approaches am I bumping into that sort of seem like next steps for me? And I feel like the last thing that I did really helped me have insight, not that helped my own practice, but also gave me insight to what my teachers who were really sort of doing things in a different way, like some of the techniques they might have been using or aware of. And so I guess it makes them even more special, but it also makes me feel like in public education and maybe other systems, but I'm interested in public education, like if those people who were teaching had the capacity to sort of shift how they did their work, then how could that be shared with like every teacher or a majority of teachers? Like how could there be a shared philosophy of the classroom and the environment that you create and the value of developing and building relationships within the classroom, when to step in as a guide and when to step back and let people do their own learning, because that's the best way of learning, So on one hand, I'm like highly critical, and on the other hand, I'm incredibly hopeful that there is place for change and growth that would make the teacher's experience too a good one.
How did you come to your philosophy as a teacher? Seems like you've really been developing out a vision for what a teacher can and should be.
Yeah, so I mean, I feel like there are a lot of things that were foundational things that were put in place that as I'm sort of seeking out now more information, I can see how like those original foundational things in place have set me up to be interested in finding these other approaches. And so I was very fortunate in that my parents always included us in their lives and didn't sort of separate the child experience from the adult experience often. So it was like, we went to museums and we went to like Shakespeare. Like when I was 3, I was going to Shakespeare performances, and somehow my parents saying, so we're going to a place, it's going to be important to be quiet. If you get tired or you don't understand, just you can put your head down on our laps. When there's intermission, you can ask your questions, you know, and they just sort of set sort of like the basic structures and rules of different spaces in place with the expectation that I could understand and follow that. And so, you know, I got to go to concerts and theater and museums, and we went camping, and, you know, just like it was this thing that the world has so many opportunities, and then going to work with them was really, really helped inform me. My mother is a book conservator, and so they would go to work on a Saturday every other week. And so I'd spend the morning in the bookbindery with my mom, and she had to work. I couldn't bother her, but there were all these scraps of materials from book. There was paper and cardboard and glue, and you know, I brought my stuff, and so I just started working with materials up there so she could do her work. And then the afternoon I'd go either down to the library or eventually down to the education department where my dad worked. And I'd work with his staff or I'd help his secretary. Like I was a great photocopier, collator, envelope stuffer, but I was also out sort of assisting their educators working with children and doing interpretation with exhibits or in gardens or, you know, just, so it was that, and working with community who would come in for special events and teach, macrame, hanging basket to the general public who came in. And so early experiences of being able to teach simple skills or share, like if people were interested, and work with different adults who were not cheating you as a child, but said, oh yeah, we need you to do this. And it's like understanding the child as capable. So I would say that outside of school, in my early life, I don't think I ever felt like a child, like I was being treated other than the adults around me, which very much matches the approaches and philosophies that I've bumped into in the past 10 years that have really resonated with me and have really drawn me in to knowing more. Like, how do we actually see the very young child, like the infant, as a human being, as deserving of respect, as highly capable, as a constantly hardworking learner, curious, you know? And I just sort of feel like not having it just be the theory, but then how, because I'm working with infants and young children, I want to learn how I do this. And so getting as much information and then bringing it into my own workplace. And then seeing the almost immediate impact that it has on our relationship, on how the day is just a comfortable day of that's so pleasant, where I'm slowing down and observing. I'm not necessarily hands-on doing, but I'm doing through stepping back and observing so that I can know who this person is who's coming into the world. And that person is very different from this person who's an infant coming into the world, and how in knowing that, can I support them by my interactions and also my stepping back. And this idea that I don't want to say it doesn't have to be hard, but there's something that, you know, and part of what I'm really studying and learning is about how do you convey this also to parents, because it's a partnership. And I am a parent of three children who are now adults, but it's that thing of like, how can you be doing all, supporting the shifts that need to happen as the adult, so that predominantly your time with your child is a pleasant one, and you'll bump into like frustrating moments as always. But to be able to recognize that there are these places of impasse, how do you understand those, and what adaptation can you make so that that's not the situation, like that doesn't have to be the situation. And you're also seeing how in making the shift, you are supporting your child in their growth and development towards independence in the world and being on solid 2 feet when they kind of head out there. Trying to think, I feel like that. So having had my own experiences and then also sort of bumping into these approaches and philosophies that really connect to my own known experiences, has been really important. Um, and to have the theory and the practice going hand in hand and moving between those two places. Yeah. And developing partnership in relationship with the child, partnerships and relationships between children, partnerships and relationships with the parent and child, you know, and what languages do you use and how do you do that? And that it's a process and each process is going to be very different, even though it has sort of the same tools based on the people, where you pull out your tools and how you use them is going to be based on experiences and sensitivities and communication and care. Like, care is so important. If you really care that there is a place to keep moving through and navigating together. I'm not sure if I answered the question, and I know that I don't have to answer the question, but.
I'm also wondering if there were any teachers, you mentioned this kindergarten teacher you had had, but what was it that teachers did that, any other memories you have of teachers doing a good job of opening up the space for you in a good way?
Yeah, so a particular teacher in eighth grade, people always say middle school is like the hardest age group. A lot of people say that to work with. And we had this wonderful English teacher who gave these assignments to us that were really about us looking at who we were, making a personal choice. In order to do the assignment, you had to make a personal choice about something, like find a song that you love. Find the lyrics of the song, this song, now. Like, interpret the lyrics. So we're all starting with a song that was meaningful to us. The assignment is interpreting poetry, but it's coming through what is meaningful to each of us as an individual. And then she always did the assignment as well. And then we all got to share, and she set up, and we all got to listen to one another. And this was a room that had like cheerleaders and jocks and like the kids who were always like stoned and smoking pot and partying and, you know, like the most disparate groups. And through each of her assignments, beginning from day one, we just became this really connected group of people who all of a sudden were saying hi to each other in the hallway, because there was this trust that was supported, that we're all sharing something that's deep and meaningful to us, including our teacher. So now we know more about her. Not only do we know that she loved Janis Joplin, and who cares if you know who Janis Joplin is or not, or you like Janis Joplin, by her taking the time and saying why she felt so strongly about something and cared about something and why it's meaningful, we got to learn about one another. It was like a little window in, you know? It was like, choose a autobiography, any autobiography you want, read it. We all went to the library together, chose our book, read our book, and then we had to create a skit based on one part of the book that we had to perform in front of the class. And I hate performing, not comfortable, but because I chose this book and I got to think about what part was so meaningful, and then how would I set that up as a short performance? It became, again, so personal and so valuable, and there was like such care, and it was so personal, but then the space was always made safe for all of the sharing. And again, we got to know about one another through that. So I think that, you know, and there were funny things, we did funny things too. So we all got to kind of laugh at one another and, yeah. And then like she and I stayed connected actually through into our, like my early adult life. And then that, but there was always that connection and we knew she had a boyfriend and we got to meet her boyfriend and, you know, so she was very much a person. She wasn't just a teacher who had a, although she had a very personal and separate life, she was willing to share who she was and develop relationship and help us develop relationship and care amongst one another. So, you know, and I feel like I had like a teacher in ninth grade who was my algebra teacher. And I now know that I am dyslexic. They were not, that wasn't anything that was being tested for or was in the world. Like it wasn't something they were taking into account when I was in school. And so from first grade on, I know that I was having issues with math and it was probably right now would have been deemed, oh, you're dyslexic. I'm like, oh, that would have been helpful in terms of setting me up for a different kind of learning. And this teacher in algebra, you know, I would struggle, but she never like berated me. She just kind of would always come up to me quietly, not publicly, and just say, come after school. We can work on this together. I'm here for you. I know you can do it. And then she always was, and she was gentle and kind, and she believed in me. I wasn't a bad student, even though I was struggling. There wasn't a good and bad student. Some people had an easier time with it. Some people had a harder time. And so they needed extra care. So again, like this word of care and that it was genuine. And one of the things that I have really seen in developing my practice of care is that if you put yourself out there in care, then you're also getting it back because the people that you're caring for feel it and give back to you like that understanding and that opening up of who they are and that's a kind of care. And you know, I have parents say like, oh, aren't you exhausted at the end of the day? And I'm like, I'm not exhausted. Like, I'm tired. I've been working for 8 hours, but I'm not exhausted. And it was just a really pleasant day, even if we had encountered some difficulty or some conflict, being able to sort of navigate and negotiate in a way that again is very caring, because you know that by dealing with something now, it's supporting like their development and growth. If you understand what's coming next, you can say, well, it's going to be important for me to hold this line, but I can do it in a caring way that supports development, you know, and supports them getting to their next place in a really solid way that they can then move from, So yeah, so those, I would say that those were like the instances that I can really, I feel like being, when you are having a hard time, when some things are hard, being seen. Also, when you know, just knowing that you're seen and that you are understood as someone other than the friend sitting next to you, you know, and that they're seen for who they are, that we're really seen for who we are. And I don't know how much extra time that takes. I feel like that if the time is taken, like the first few weeks of school, to say we're going to focus on relationship, because as a class, we can then move forward into this year in a better way that is fulfilling to most of us. You know, I always know there are exceptions, but, and that it's regenerative. I really am believing in this sort of regenerative quality of care in what you do. If you put care into what you do, whatever it is, then you will be given back to, like, manifold. It'll just be, yeah, so.
I would love to get a description of what, just, you know, I don't really know what your life as an educator is like. Could you tell me about, like, a typical day in your classroom? Who's there? What's it like? And to just say for the record where you're teaching now.
So the work that I do, because I begin with infants, is I work out of families' homes. So I don't necessarily have a school. And, you know, it keeps shifting and changing as I grow and sort of feel more comfortable and confident, but it's sort of connecting with the infant a day or two a week, and then maybe another infant a day or two a week. And then as that relationship feels solid with them, being able to bring, I just for the first time this year felt comfortable and curious about having two children the same age doing what I call share care in one family's home. And the children, I think they were 4 months when I started with them, two boys, and just beginning. And so we just, you know, it's just a very gentle start to the day. And so my practice now with infants, and it always has been, but I feel like I'm very much more conscious about, like, how I move into something. So it's immediate, it's very gentle, it's eye contact, it's talking to the infant. Hello, how are you? I see you. Asking permission, like, are you ready for me to hold you now? You know, and building time into the day. If I'm having to bring this one child, pick them up at their house, put them in a car seat in my car to take them to the other house, it's building in enough time so that it's not, I'm doing this thing to you. I'm coming and doing this thing. I'm picking you up. I'm putting you in your coat. I'm putting you in the car seat. I'm putting you in the car. We're doing this together. Hi, how are you? I see you. I'm going to sit with you for a little bit. You're going to show me something. Okay, we need to start getting ready to go now. We're going to go, you know, see Phoenix. We're going to go to Phoenix's house. Let's find your coat. I need your help. We need to put your hand in, like, you know, okay. And then just sort of taking time to pause and recognize, like, okay, we've got that on. Okay, like, next we're going to have to, we need to get in the car seat so we can go on this car ride. And just when they start to get upset, just sort of bringing them back in. Hey, you know, use their name. Hey, so-and-so, like, let's stop. Okay, you know. And that there is this, even though language isn't fully developed, they've been hearing language and rhythms and tones from in utero. So there are already these things that they're meeting now outside of the parent who carried them after birth. And they already have something that they're building language on when as infants. And so we're also helping them gain language by looking and talking to them and saying, I don't know what of what I'm saying you're understanding. It could be tone, it could be expression. I don't know when you're going to start necessarily recognizing certain words. That's a very quiet process. But I'm going to say that I'm going to give you the opportunity to understand me, and I'm going to pause, and I'm going to give you the opportunity through whatever language you're able to, if it's a smile or an arm motion or something, to respond back to me, you know, and we're just going to make it gentle. And we're going to keep bringing the attention back. We're not going to distract you with things. We're going to just keep the attention back to you and me, and that we're doing this together. And you know, the same, like, to me right now, I'm seeing, like, this is the same with adults. Like, when people are getting crazy at each other, it's like, what about that? Okay. I just had to do this recently, like, with an adult, and they were getting frustrated with a piece of technology, a device, and were asking for help. And I'm like, I'd like to help you. And I realized I was just moving in and being like, here, give me the phone, I'll show you, you know? And I realized that that wasn't working. That was setting up a really bad dynamic. And so I finally realized, like, I need to use those things that I use with young children, just because I'm dealing with an adult in their 80s, you know? So I'm gonna be like, so I know this is frustrating, right? So I'd really like to help you do this. So there are a few ways, like, if you want, like, if you'd let me hold your device, like, I can show you, you know, you can try it yourself. Or if you want, can I touch your thumb and double push on that button? And we, you know, and then there was, like, continued frustration. I said, so right now, you're having really a hard time hearing me. So I actually told the person they were a bad learner, which I shouldn't have said, but I said, you're being a really bad student right now because you're not listening. And so what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna stop. When you're ready for me to continue, like, or to show you, you can come and ask me to show you. Like, I'm gonna let you get ready to come to be in this learning environment again. Because, like, right now you're shut down to I can tell you're not listening to hear. I can tell by your actions. So anyway, I feel like my typical day with children is that the beginning place is always that place of hi. We're not going to jump into it. How are you? Where are you at today? Right now, where are you at? Because that's our beginning place. And I prepared myself to be in this space. I don't have any of my business coming in. I'm here with you. And you're going to tell me, and that's going to set the tone for our day. And then I'll know how I need to be with you today. And you're going to show me things. And I will get to see what you're interested in today. Like, what's the thing that's really connecting with you today? And we're gonna move on from that. You're gonna lead this. And maybe it's a really beautiful day. So maybe we'll move this thing that you're really interested in outdoors. And then we'll see where it goes from there. You know, and so, but then there's always that me keeping track and saying, oh my gosh, it's almost lunchtime. I want to not rush into that. I want to have time to transition. So respecting the other person, probably needing time to know that something's going to happen and then make the moves, be able to stop what they're doing in their time as much as possible, and then move into the next thing. And so I feel like that's the typical thing that I have, is that we have this morning time where they're sort of initiating, leading. Maybe I've brought something that I might put out and set in front of them as an invitation, something open-ended. I'm like, because I've imagined, like, oh, this could be really interesting here. I wonder what would happen if I brought this and presented it to them. Wonder what they would do with this. So I will also bring things and invite children in to explorations to see what comes of it. And then just the basic structures of lunch and rest and afternoon time and then closure for the day. And so that does not change with the aged child. It's just what they're capable of as they grow sort of shifts the things that we're able to do and informs like next things, you know. So it keeps it always interesting because development happens so rapidly. Especially the first year is astonishing. It's like from having very little muscle and control, right, to walking, from making sounds to making words that any adult can understand. So that first year is so stunning. And then each year after that, it's like, oh, and now we're here, and now we're here. And so, so I will bring families together as I can. Maybe a family will say, oh, I have a friend who has a child. So I have like these little cohorts that of children that usually start around infancy that I sort of carry on through. So I have a little group of 3-year-olds now who I have through the summer, and then they're going to move on to another school. They'll be 4. So I've been with all of them from infancy, and my desire is to just be supporting them to be very strong in who they are and know how who they are, and to be supported in their development, which should bring them to the place where they're ready to be in a preschool setting, you know, and hopefully in a place that also shares a similar philosophy of sort of honor, respect, that the child is capable. And relationship also then with the parent too, is that just touching base in the morning of, so how did the child sleep? Has the child had breakfast today? Like, where are you at? Where are you at as a family? What am I stepping into today in your story as a family? And I think that's really important. And then also making sure that there's time for the parent. Like, we have a lot of sharing. We have a lot of questions that come up. I don't even try to say that I'm an expert, but what I try to do is listen to what their questions are and say, based on sort of my experience or the things that I've studied or the things that I'm doing, there are a number of things that you might try if you haven't tried already. You know, that what works for me is going to be very different than what works for them. They're the parent. They have a very different relationship with their child. They have a very different life. And so giving and offering things, a variety of things or things that they could read, but just being as open and available to the parent as possible, so that we feel like we're all coming together in support of the child, that the child is our place of working together and our priority together.
How has your role changed since the onset of COVID-19?
So that is, I immediately stopped working with my 4 families that I care for very rapidly. Everybody decided on their own that they wanted to self-isolate. And so I suddenly wasn't doing my work anymore. And one of the things that I came up with, I wanted to stay connected with them because I was hearing from the parents, you know, a lot of what they were going through. And I knew that the sudden break from being with me could, like, for the first week or two might be normal, like Maya's on vacation, but at a certain point, they might start responding to that, not having me in their life on a weekly basis and almost daily basis. So I figured out, I played with ways of recording myself reading stories to them and picture books, and really tried to emulate what it would feel like if they were sitting next to me and looking at the pictures while I was reading the story to them, and that my hands were very, so that, you know, so I had to like figure out all these ways to do it with my phone, you know, and I, but I came up with a method that I felt really good about that also showed my hand, you know, and I was speaking to and I started sharing it also with other early educators that I work with, and, you know, got feedback that sometimes was like, well, it'd be really nice if they could at least see your face to start with before you started reading the story. So it wasn't just your voice and the pictures. And I was like, oh, that's really, you know, so like the collaborative effort of COVID, like we were reaching out to one another, like, how are you? What's happening at your end? This is what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing. How are you staying connected? How are you staying safe? How are your families? What are you seeing? And so, so that was really like, that was like immediate, is like that we were sharing with one another so that we could find ways that resonated with ourselves in ways of taking care of our families and children, in all of this. And so then, you know, I'm the youth commissioner as of January of Hudson, which has been a really big honor, but also something where I'm like, well, what does a youth commissioner do? And so our youth department, because it stopped serving children right away at the shutdown, our youth director was like, well, we feed the children that come to the youth center snack and dinner 5 nights a week. So that means that a number of our children in this community are not going to have that food available to them that many families depend on. So we need to make sure that our families are getting food and feel safe around food. And what's that going to look like? And within a week and a half of shutdown, we had like really scrambled and determined that the best thing was putting together boxes of provisions and getting them to our families. But there were so many households in need that it was like anybody who signed up with us would get a box of food twice a week. And so it just became this really incredible effort. And so that became my job. 2 days a week, I was packing groceries for 6 hours as part of this food distribution program. And it helped me as youth commissioner to like get to know the staff of the youth department better, get to really understand how they worked and how they served community, how they felt about the families and children that they worked with. And it absolutely completely resonated with, like, there's this deep level of care. And we are available at all times for our families. We are going to try to hone in on what the most essential needs are. And we are going to then keep also developing our programming and what we can offer. And so it really, I think, brought us together. So it's just another level of like, so I work with these families for my profession and these babies, but now like also part of the philosophy that I've really, really connected with is that how do we understand the youngest people, the children in our communities as citizens? And how do we bring that visibility up into our community? That these are not just children that we're waiting to become grownups, but it is our responsibility to respect them and support them in their growing and consider them to have voices in our community as well and needs from the community. So how do we serve that? How do we serve our youngest citizens? And how do we understand them as that? And I feel like through this effort, I feel like we have quite a ways to go, but I feel like we really came in with care. And now with COVID, and we didn't think we have a summer camp, and we didn't think we would have summer camp at all. And then our governor started opening things up very quickly and gave permission for day camps to happen. And so we're like, oh my God, we're getting food out. But now we need to really realize that we have this opportunity now to be hands-on with youth again. And these children haven't been in school for 4 months. Like, there are real needs too about time and learning and reconnecting, but reconnecting in new ways, you know, under the new COVID, you know, safety mandates. But it's essential for us to be in touch with the kids and to make sure that they have a safe summer and a summer where they have things and people things that they can engage with and people that they know care about them to engage with. And it gives us a chance to also monitor how they're doing and to step in if we need to, you know, and get information about how we can better serve children and families. It's been really incredible to watch how we've sort of reformed or how the staff here in this community has stepped into, these are different ways that we can do it under these new structures, with these new mandates, because we want everybody to be safe. Safety's been a huge thing in our community. We've done a very good job of it. It's our job to also convey the importance of safety, but that we can come together, and how do you come together in a safe way to model it? So for me, COVID has connected me to sort of community of young people. That's been really important because I feel like it is a part of my story because I've been so focused on infants and toddlers, but I want this to be like a bigger, broader platform, you know? And so how can I use my place as commissioner to take these things that I use in my own work to be part of the work that I do in my community, in my city, and finding the people to share the work with. So it's been very informative, both through conversation and through hands-on and relationship building. Yeah. So I hope that we can use this as our next level platform to build and grow that voice. And the other thing that has happened is that all of the youth organizations in our small community of about 7,000 people, and there are a number of youth organizations, we all found ourselves saying, what are our summer programs gonna look like? And can we have summer programs? And so there is a collective organization that's been around for a number of years that meets monthly. And so that platform was used by all the organizations there were already a lot of collaborations happening, but that it became a collective effort to figure out how we as a community of youth organizations were going to share this group of 600, serve these 600 young people. And that we all had a part in it, that these 600 children were all of our children, and that we could all sort of do some little thing that was different, but if we communicated, we could offset one another and not be competing and make sure that the children were cared for every day for at least 5 to 7 hours a day, that we all could somehow be making, filling all those gaps of time for them. So, yeah, so I mean, just really, and then again, moving forward into the future, I feel like maybe this is shifting something in our community, and that we're going to be able to sort of really do even more extraordinary work than we've already been able to do moving forward, because we're really shining right now. Like the city, you know, administration is really seeing how we're rising to the occasion. And not only how we're rising, but the value to the physical and mental health, spiritual well-being of children and families at this sort of crisis time. So. And I've just started working with my families again. So I'm just getting, and it's really amazing. And it's a lot about communication. It's a lot about making sure that we're doing everything possible in our own personal lives to take safety precautions and to just be very honest and clear if something has shifted or changed, and the actions that we're taking to make sure that we're safe and we're taking care of ourselves and one another. So yeah, it's been really, really interesting. And the child who was 7 months old when I stopped working with him totally remembers me, and he's like 15 months old. And he was like a little shy for like a second when I first saw him. And then he came over and he just put his arms out, like, lift me up. Like, and I'm like, that's incredible. So that relationship that started, you know, at 3 or 4 weeks old really sustained us through 4 months of not physically being together, and every now and then, like maybe 5 FaceTime connections, you know? So to me, that focus on relationship has sustaining impact in our lives, no matter when we begin that first moment of relating. If we take that time, that can be a very deeper than we could even know connection.
What has life been like for you outside of caring for these young ones and stepping into this big role as the youth commissioner?
It's been interesting to have to kind of figure it out as I go, because again, I guess it's that, it's kind of like my work with babies. It's what is already here, what's here, and how are things working? And not stepping in with an agenda, right? It's like, well, what is already here? Understanding the story of youth organizations in the community, the people involved, how things are being done now, how to support it and not get in the way of work that is being done, of a vision that already might exist. It's not my vision, but how can I come to understand so that I can find the place that I can either say, how do you see me supporting you, or me being able to see something that maybe I could offer, say, would it be helpful if, or, you know, So that dance of not being somebody who comes in and imposes an idea, but does have a belief, but how to see that belief, how to share and have those conversations and find the place of commonality to support what already exists, or to sort of when to come in and say, okay, I think we need to focus on this now, because I see this, I'm seeing this big change and shift, which means we need to come in. So it mean, and if we're going to come in and create youth programs suddenly very quickly, it means that we're going to have to shift how we're doing food programming, and knowing when to use sort of a stronger, bolder voice, you know. And I feel like in the world of all adults, so I find this very challenging, because I feel like part of what has always drawn me to working with children is I feel like that relationship is, to me, like the clearest, most honest way of relating to another human being. Like children are, it's clear, it's clean, it's honest, but it's also, you can move through a lot of different kinds of feelings and conflict and be fine. Like you can just, it's an easier world for me to navigate. And so adults are so much more complex, right? And we're complex because often of things that were happening in our own childhoods from infancy, right? So it's like when I'm with an adult, I'm like, whoa, I'm feeling like this pushback. So I'm going to step back. Is it me? Is it you? Get to know your story a little bit. Like maybe why is this how you present? So that I can know how to work with that. Because if I understand that something happened to you in your life, or that, you know, to always remember the child and the adult, because we are who we are, like there's that linear story, there's that story of who we are, but it began at conception or birth or wherever you want to start your story, but it started early. And by the time we're adults, what are we using to get what we need or want? How are we projecting? What tool are we choosing to use, you know? And was that something you used to do when you were in high school, or when you were a four-year-old, or like, have you always had this behavior and you just didn't adapt it, or it didn't develop, or it didn't mature? Anyway, what I want to say is I find that I am having to listen and pick up on like other language cues, from expression to like a jittery leg to fingers to you're not really listening to me, I can tell. So now I have to position myself differently because I need you to hear me. Like I need you to respect me right now and hear what I'm saying. So it's like a trickier, you know, and when you're working in this world, like I was appointed, I'm not, and I don't desire to be in politics. So I'm just like, I want to just do the work, but I'm working with in a political machine, you know? So I'm like, oh my God, this is so complicated. Like there's so much politics, and there's like old politics and there's new politics. And it's just like, oh, so I find it exhilarating and also frustrating. I find it a puzzle, a challenge. Something that there are times where I'm just like, I want to maybe just be like, maybe I'm not cut out to do this. And then I'm like, okay, just make that phone call or have that conversation. Like I've learned a lot about how that conversation you don't want to have, you have to have, because that's the only way to have forward movement. So I am experiencing like my own sort of adult maturation. Like, okay, I'm here, and these are the things that I've struggled with. for my whole life from childhood. And here's a place where I kind of have to, can't use that anymore. It doesn't work. It's not as responsible as it could be. You know, if I want to really be responsible to this, you know, thing I took on and said I would do, okay, then I need to have courage, and there are things that I haven't been courageous about. So it's really great. I feel like there's a real team effort at play, which is why I'm doing it. Our new administration, our new mayor came in saying, I'm not doing this by myself. It's all hands on deck, which is, you know, what was said through the whole campaign. And he won. And like the campaign was run through everybody hunkering down and making it happen in whatever way they could. And again, it's in a way, it's very open-ended, which can sometimes be confusing. Because I'm someone who actually likes to touch base and meet with people and be like, okay, how are you feeling about this? I just want your feedback, because that helps me know how I can adjust things. So I feel like, you know, sometimes I need more of that. But I feel like for the most part, I feel like with, especially with COVID, like it kind of equalized or leveled out the playing field, because we are all vulnerable, you know? And so, and we all kind of need one another. And so communication is just critical to us all being safe. And I'm curious to see how it unfolds. I have like another year and a half in this commitment. There's a daycare in Hudson that, as commissioner, when the mayor declared a state of emergency in Hudson, because I had already been in conversation with this daycare center, I encouraged them to close 3 days earlier than they were. They were going to close for a week because we didn't know what was happening with COVID, where it was going. But because of the state of things and that all of the youth departments and youth organizations were shutting down in step with the city, I really, really encouraged them highly to do the same for the well-being of their staff and for the children and the families, because we didn't know anything about how this was going to move through our community and impact one another. And they did do that. And I realized then that there is a level of power to have this position that I still am coming to terms with, because I don't put myself in that position in my life. Like, I rise to occasions when I need to in order to make sure things are safe and okay, but only so I take that power really seriously, because I don't know what it is to some degree, and I want to make sure that I'm being responsible with it, because I still don't understand what it is. You know, it's really interesting. So I realized it was a big responsibility, and now they're getting ready to open, but they've been closed for 4 months. And this daycare center serves the low-income and migrant community predominantly. And so the money that comes into the daycare is as a subsidy through the child, and only for the hours the child is there. So it's very small amount of money, and then they have a few grants. So they've always kind of just been on that edge. And right now with COVID, there's statistics out there that suggests that only about half of the daycare centers in this country are going to survive COVID. And so to me, they are one of those daycares that could easily not survive it. And so I've been working with the director to come up with ways to for it to open and for us to create a team around it, a support team that it needs anyway. And to really start using my resources of the past 10 years in early education and also as a community member who has worked with youth and families for those 19 years and knows community. Like I could conceivably have resources that could help support this daycare center. The idea of it closing is, it would just be really, really unfortunate in so many ways, especially because right now we find ourselves in a community that is gentrifying so rapidly that low-income community is disappearing. So housing stock and affordable housing stock is almost gone. And so this is critical. Like how we care for children is how we care for families, is how we care for community. Our community and a diverse community cannot exist if we're not caring for those children and families. And so that's where we're at right now. And so I'm beginning to focus my attention with my knowledge base of early education and my community of early education professionals to like, how can we do this? How can we do this in a creative way? How can we do this in a way where I can maybe also bring in like my years of professional development and finding these approaches that I've been very all kind of overlap one another in that they respect the young child and consider the young child capable. All children, no matter what economic group, demographic they're born into, that all children are deserving of respect and are capable and are self-learners. And so we need to offer up that opportunity. So I'm like, well, this school is like the prime place where this should be playing out. Like that blendings of Montessori and Waldorf and Rye and like all of these very old approaches and philosophies that are still valuable, if not more valuable now because of their understanding of child development. Like these things in our country are available to people who can afford it. The Montessoris are expensive schools. The Waldorfs are expensive private schools. Very few people know about Rye. They need to be brought back to the people. You know, Montessori came out of Dr. Maria Montessori is a pediatrician looking at orphans and saying they have to stop being sidelined in society. Like we need to create a space where they can then enter society from because they are capable. And there are these methods of learning that all children, you know, are deserving of having, you know, and so it's interesting to me that, anyway, my dream and desire is that I can bring that into this daycare center in a gentle, respectful way and get a team around it so that it can actually not only survive, but thrive and become like indicative of how early care can look. That's my big fantasy.
What have you learned in this time that you want to carry forward as you drive towards this vision and dream and idea that you have?
So much. It's just really to allow myself to take the time, even if there are lots of pressures, to make things happen quickly, to really hold the value of taking time to allow something to unfold, just like a child, like ideas also have a life of their own. It's, again, not imposing it. And there are so many things that will feed into that. So just, and continue, and being a listener, recognizing right now in time with all of, with the Black Lives Matter movement and conversations around, you know, race and ethnicities, like, I applied, they were looking for a director 6 years ago, and I applied for the position and didn't get it. So it's been on my radar for a long time. 6 years ago, 6 months ago, I would have felt very comfortable being like, yes, I want to be the director. I can be the director of this daycare serving the low-income migrant community based on sort of my studies and my knowledge and my desires for the world. Now I say, maybe I'm not the best person to be director, but my job as youth commissioner is I can bring a team together that stabilizes it so they can search for the person who would be the best director for this daycare. So really kind of how to sort of keep myself out of it, but be critically involved. Taking, really checking my ego and saying, I don't have to be the person. Like six years ago, I was like, yeah, pick me, you know, and even 6 months ago, yeah, you know, great opportunity. Because I'm getting older. It makes sense for me to sort of think about how will I keep working into my 70s. Probably a director of a center where I can sort of develop a space with these practices would be a great next step in my own, sustaining my own day-to-day and my own career. And just saying that right now isn't the most important thing. The most important thing is how can I use what I have to save and support this daycare and have it sort of make shifts and changes that I believe would serve the community better. I really, it's that way of not feeling like I have to be central to something, but where is my place in supporting it, whatever it's going to be, into being the best thing it can be with the right people in the right instances? Yeah. And saying, I have no idea what the future is going to hold. I don't know what it's going to be like for me when I'm 60, 70, 80. You know, but a certain amount of trust again. And I think that I am absolutely not the only one in that position right now.
I also wanted to ask you, what has life been like outside of work for you in this time?
That is so... this past year, this is like the beginning of a story. So my parents, we put into place this project where we would make my house into a two-family house. And so I spent last year as sort of the general contractor. My parents live in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. They retired there to what used to be the cabin that my great-grandparents from Finland built and owned. So it goes back to that story of my great-grandmother and my great-grandfather from Finland. And so they've been retired up there for 13 years, but as they're getting older, we decided that they decided winters were going to get a little harder for them and that they would come and reside in Hudson in their own apartment for 5 months of the year. So this year was the first winter that they did that. And then COVID struck and they're in their 80s. And so they were living downstairs from me. And so I became kind of like the person who went out and did the grocery shopping. And we separated our households because I was going out into the community with this food distribution program. And we wanted to make sure that they were safe. So we created a table in the hallway where we could exchange parts of meals and FaceTime while they ate downstairs and I ate upstairs and those sorts of things. And then they got kind of stuck here for an extra couple of months. And I have a number of friends in their 70s and 80s. So I put out to that community of friends, like two or three other households, that I go grocery shopping on Wednesdays and Saturdays for our households. If you get me your lists, I will shop for you. So as my life has been very much like full on, either caring for the community or caring for like my older parents and my older community of friends. And when I was ready to go back to work of caring for children, I knew that I was going to have to self-quarantine, so I had to ease myself out of the food distribution program so I could have 2 weeks at home before I entered the other households. And that was like 4 months after COVID. So I'd been working, so busy, so like city meetings, like just constant. And all of a sudden, I had nothing. And that was just the weirdest thing for me, because I was like, what do I do? Like, oh, you know, like I could do that project. I found myself really just very disoriented and not able to do an awful lot, but kind of sit around, lie around, like in this very perplexed way state. So yeah, and then it became about getting my parents starting work again, and then getting my parents safely back up to Michigan, which I've just come home from. So sort of following in my car and making sure that we were moving across the country and staying in hotels and eating in safe ways, making sure that we understood safe protocols of them doing their own grocery shopping and how to sort of set up schedules that would allow them to go to the store every 3 days and break from their normal routines, remembering that they were going to be taking care of themselves, that I was no longer a resource. And then me coming back and saying, I hope that you stay healthy. I hope you don't get COVID. And I hope in November, when it's time for you to come back to New York State for your winter residency in Hudson, that you can, and knowing I'm not sure how they're going to make that trip and if they'll be able to. So yeah, it's been very centered around safety protocols and trying to be connected with people again. Yeah. And mind over matter, having to remember now as we've opened so fast that things aren't the same and that we still have to be mindful and that we're kind of losing the time. Not only are we losing the time, but we're losing possibly the contemplation that can come with time. And then the thing that time offers us on the other side of contemplation is the time to actually create a different way of doing things, moving forward. And on my drive home, after I read this article from the New York Times, my driving time, I rarely listen to anything when I'm driving, and I was tapping, sorry. There was this article in the Times about, like, with the tuberculosis, you know, outbreak in New York City at the turn of the century, how there was this, all of a sudden, these outdoor schools, outside schools, and that these were ways that past eras have dealt with epidemics. And so there's a lot of conversation, especially among progressive early education, like schools, early educators, about why aren't we just being outside more, more outdoor school, more out, bring it outside. And then I'm watching cultural institutions, especially in big cities, being so impacted by loss of visitors and things like that. But most cultural institutions are also places of research and academia. And I'm like, why aren't we like putting up yurts around the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and then their staff is collaborating with public school educators in New York City, and that you can bring small groups of children into the museum, and that you're also maybe one of the curators or one of the, you know, whoever, or the people in the museum who are working in museums are also a part of that sort of facilitating education. And why isn't that coming together as a way of sort of shifting also that cultural institutions are a part of and should be available to our everyday as inspiring thought and informing thought and informing next ideas and understanding past. Like, why were they separated? Why not bring those to the institution of education, public education institution, cultural institutions together, so that we don't lose either?
Is there anything else that you want to add about your visions and dreams for what, how we might adapt and learn and shift how we do things in as COVID continues, as well as in a post-COVID world?
Yeah. So yeah, a lot of thoughts about like sort of reflections on stories that friends of mine, older friends, would share about having grown up in the city. And neighborhoods, like the city's different now. It used to be these little neighborhoods. And even if your mom wasn't around, you had to watch it because like your friend's mom or neighbor would see you do something and then your mom would hear about it, you know? And like the neighborhood watched for the children and shared in a way, the raising of the children. And we've gotten so far away from that kind of connection with one another. Over like multiple decades, that now that we've slowed down and stopped, now that people are working from home more, or until unemployment runs out, you know, like there are people who are able to actually be home and be getting unemployment and be with their children. Like, so I'm curious about, can we break ourselves down into like community neighborhood pods again, so that we can then determine what collective resources exist in those pods that are more manageable in size, and say, can we use sort of this idea of share care, that like this thing that I'm doing with little children where I'm serving multiple families, and Could somebody be paid to be with five children and connected to education with a few parents? Like, is there a way that there could be a subsidy to bring a teacher or facilitator of education into a neighborhood or small pods with parents working with children and offset one another. And then saying, what are our outdoor resources and, you know, and whose house can we use? What houses in the neighborhood are available, or what spaces in the neighborhood? Is there a church space? Is there, you know, a space that is no longer used because everybody's working remotely in this office building? But can we use these as sites of small group? Like, how can we reconsider space working with small groups? Who works with small groups? Who liaisons with teachers and schools? How are schools a part of that conversation? So that schools don't feel alone in trying to figure this out. But how can schools become integrated with community instead of separate? And that parents are a resource as much as teachers, as much as other, I call us outsider educators because we don't fit in other sort of more defined educational parameters. So yeah, I'm just sort of curious about how we can revisit that sort of more neighborhood size and come up with our ideas based on the community. And then an alliance of those pods so that you can be sharing, like, we did this really cool thing, you know, or we're having trouble with this thing, or we want our kids to be outside, but our community don't have the financial resources to get like weatherproof gear, or, you know, like what's out there. And yeah. Anyway.
Well, I love hearing about your dreams and visions for the future. And as we come to the close of this interview, I'm wondering if there's anything else that you'd like to add on the record, even if it's just for you to remember.
I would say slow down and stay in time. And be watching and listening and thinking together and caring deeply about yourself and what you do and about others, but slow down and care.
Well, thank you so much, Maya. It's been great to spend the time with you.
Thank you so much, Noah. It's been really nice meeting you through this.